Will you all take your seats? Because we just have under an hour for this event, because there's another lecture in here at 2 o'clock. I'm very, very pleased on behalf of the Centre for the Study of Global Governance and the Global Dimensions Programme to be able to welcome Mark Malik Brown, who's the administrator of the UNDP. I think it's very fitting that we have him here today. His subject is human security and human development in the 21st century. And I think all of us feel that in this particular crisis, first of all, it's terribly important that the United Nations has a prominent role. And secondly, that if we are to deal with terrorism, we have to think very seriously about issues of justice and human development. And so for all these reasons, I think it's very good that we have Mark Malik Brown here to listen to. And without any further ado, I'll ask him to speak. Well.
Thank you very much, Mary, and I can't think of a more appropriate centre or a more appropriate group of people to share these ideas with, and certainly not in a more appropriate time to do it than now. Obviously, the events of September 11th and what they mean for any of us in our personal lives, our professional lives, it's still very close. I think we all lack any real sense of perspective on it. But life moves on, and we must all adjust our activities to try and draw the right conclusions and try and focus on the right things. And for the United Nations, I think it's a clear two-track. The one track is we are, after all, an intergovernmental security organization in part, and the need to manage, or and certainly not manage, but at least try and influence the direction of the military response is an extraordinary responsibility at this time, to try and ensure that it is kept within boundaries that make it a justifiable act of self-defense and does not allow the conflict to spill more broadly into the Central Asian and Middle Eastern regions. But there is a second role, and that is for the UN and its friends to start seeking to raise awareness and to build support for redressing the political environment that allowed this terrible tragedy to happen. Now, I think the immediate cause, turning to that environment, was a very inside issue, and we should never forget that. It was a group of individuals who have a very fundamental quarrel with the government of Saudi Arabia about the Islamic integrity and legitimacy of that state. And their immediate allies were from countries such as Egypt, where Egyptians have a similar quarrel with their state. And in drawing the conclusions, we should remember that narrow core issue at the heart of this, because there is a danger that I think we jump too generally to the state of the world and the state of world poverty to explain what happened. I think those broader issues of global poverty, those broader unaddressed issues such as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, created, if you like, a broader enabling political environment. They provided causes which allowed a very small inside issue to resonate across the streets of a very large part of the world. And indeed, it is those broader issues that I think we have to address, while recognizing, as I've said, that I think we make an analytical error to believe that they were the immediate trigger causes of what happened. And indeed, in this jump to too quickly assign broader blame in the broader environment for this, I think poor old globalization has taken some early hits. And yet, obviously, it has indeed suffered some significant injuries as a result of what happened. While the government of Saudi Arabia may have been the direct target for what happened, or at least the direct political target for what happened, there is no doubt that the anger of the Al-Qaeda terrorist movement is in part determined by a broader sense that global culture is being consistently and steadily Americanized. There is a second, equally important sense that the globalized world is an increasingly unfair one, where almost half of the world population lives on less than $2 a day. Yet again, before sort of getting into what we can do about those things, I think it's very important to remind ourselves that the actual operatives of this action were middle-class kids with pilot's licenses. And indeed, that globalization in some ways enabled the attack, that IT and communications were very critical to this, and indeed, the other instruments of globalization, the passenger aircraft, was the weapon for it. And that in that sense, enemies of globalization may be, but also citizens living in a globalized world, one where globalization creates real opportunity, but also real threat and risk, as this clearly demonstrated. Now, if we step back and wonder to what extent the development model that many of us have supported in recent years is challenged by this, obviously it is globalization and its success as an instrument in reducing poverty that I think we're most concerned about. And clearly the analysis of whether globalization works for the poor has to go beyond the surface statistics, which, while complicated, are I think relatively indisputable. These numbers may not be, but the basic trend is, which is that during the 1990s, countries whose share of their economy became increasingly, whose share of their economy was increasingly of that of international trade, grew, and those which reduced their exposure to international trade shrunk. The first group grew at an average of 5.1% a year of developing countries, and the second group of developing countries contracted at an average of 1.1% a year. So trade integration, on the face of it, is correlated extremely strongly with growth. But obviously, the conclusion that has been drawn, which is that open markets and trade integration are enough, is clearly insufficient. And if that was the assumption of the so-called Washington Consensus, the economic model which dominated thinking about development in the late 80s and early 90s, already it is a Washington Consensus Mark II. And in fact, there are various world capitals where various meetings have been held which lay claim to the new consensus. You hear of a Santiago Consensus and an Ottawa Consensus and a Copenhagen Consensus. But whatever it is, it's a general view amongst policymakers around the world that it's not enough to rely on the argument that the rising tide of global integration will lift all boats. There is a sense that there must be, at the very least, interventions to address the weaknesses of certain countries' ability to compete in that global economy. And in that sense, we've seen increased spending by the UN system, by the World Bank and the IMF, by DFID and other donors around the world on health and education. And we've seen developing countries themselves dramatically shift their spending priorities in favor of health and education. And that goes back to the Copenhagen summit of 10 years ago, 11 years ago now. And it's part of a sense that only countries which conserve and invest in their own human capital, which understand that the global market is in many senses a knowledge economy, it's only countries which meet that challenge of investment in their own people which are going to succeed. There's also a growing sense that underlying the global economy is a very Darwinian risk for countries that fail, and particularly for groups within societies that fail. Groups caught up in economic adjustments which make their particular contribution to their nation's economy suddenly redundant. The 21st century equivalent of handloom weavers, and there are lots of them. Russian miners, Asian rubber planters, and the list goes on of people whose particularly commodity contributions to the world economy is suddenly overcome by technology breakthroughs or changes in the terms of trade or changes in labor costs which make countries move to other suppliers. And from farmers in Thailand complaining about competition in the domestic rice market because of globalization to steel workers in the US, in my job I am constantly hearing of the social costs of adjustment in this new competitive, barrierless global market that we're moving towards. And as I say, the reaction of those promoting the global model has been very much to say, well, we need social safety nets. We need to make sure that people are helped through the transition costs of this. But when I put all this together and hear of a modified global market vision of development where we must supplement the operations of the market with some limited social interventions which appear to ameliorate the worst of the social ills we face, you know, I'm struck by two things. First, a sense that if we could have believed before September 11th, we certainly can't afterwards, the proposition that it's not enough. It's not enough. We need a much more vigorous vision of how to manage the global economy and global society. And one's also struck by the sense of some parallel, that perhaps indeed listening to these various ameliorating social initiatives, the desire, for example, to encourage the international corporate sector to engage in social responsibility. All of these activities, every one of which I wholeheartedly support and endorse, and some of them have been quite instrumental in making happen, one is nevertheless left with the sense that a few years' time we may look back at what people have said about modifying globalization to work, make it work for the poor, and that we were like a sort of late Lloyd George cabinet minister, introducing as a Liberal government last measures of social reform, but with a very unclear sense that round the corner was the first Labour government with a much more comprehensive vision of how to put together a system of globalization which really worked for all. And I think we may be on the edge of that real paradigm shift, where we're on the edge of really thinking very differently about how to manage globalization. Already, if you like, a framework for that is emerging. And it's heard in the words that I think used to be in the footnotes and have now made the chapter headings of an LSE reading course, words such as global public goods. The sense that there are certain issues, such as the environment, and particularly an aspect of it like climate change, which we cannot handle at the national level, which require a global response, or HIV/AIDS. Each of these issues where your security is my security, an HIV/AIDS epidemic allowed to rage unchecked in Africa, being a health threat in London or New York. Climate change issues being allowed to rage uncontrolled in terms of emissions control in the US, being of passionate interest to all of us everywhere in terms of the containing of them. And the all of us everywhere is very important, because a little bit of the early global public goods discussion has had a quality of it of if we can't ring the lager to protect our lifestyles in the West, how do we manage others so that they don't impinge on those lifestyles? But if you take climate change, the most dramatic victims of climate change are not those with second homes in Cornwall or Long Island. They are people living in Gujarat and other parts of the Asian subcontinent. The greater propensity of natural disasters, the quickening cycle of floods and droughts that we're seeing in Asia and other regions, clearly correlates to global climate change. And without getting deep into the Kyoto debate, we know where to point the finger. And by the way, it's not exclusively at the US. Over time, it will be to other industrializing countries as they contribute. But nevertheless, what this is forging is a new pragmatic sense of international independence. You don't have to be a one-worlder. You don't have to be a direct intellectual descendant of Woodrow Wilson. You don't even have to think the UN is the best institution ever created to believe that your immediate personal environment is now at risk because of global problems raging out of control. Political problems, security problems, public health problems, migration problems, crime, drug problems. The agenda is growing of issues which can no longer be contained and managed within the boundaries of the single nation state, however powerful. And behind this agenda lies the 800-pound gorilla issue, the half the world almost living on less than $2 a day, that broader economic failure, which doesn't just point a finger of guilt at a model which makes half the world richer and leaves the other half of the world lives largely unchanged. It's a much more direct challenge to us than that. Because in a world, an almost virtual world of media interconnectedness, and certainly a virtual world of threat in terms of the epidemiology of diseases, crime, and terrorism, it is a world where we all live cheek to jowl, and where the 875 million illiterates in the world, the 325 million kids who are not in school today, are building up a problem not just in their own nation's future, but for all of us. And behind this issue of economic failure leads some fundamental issues of distribution at the country level. Governments that are failing to generate growth in their economies, literally millions of people each year joining the job markets of in Central Asia, from Pakistan to Iran through to North Africa, countries such as Egypt and Morocco and Algeria. But also those same crises of economic failure and the failure to create the jobs equally evident in Africa. And perhaps as we address that, a sense that there is now a global responsibility. It is a global economy. It must operate at an expansionary level at the global level, but that must be sustained by smart national policies. The privilege of economic failure at the national level is no longer one that governments absolutely own. Governments which fail their own people in terms of the provision of jobs and education and healthcare fail us all because of the threat it poses. And you see the reflection of that new reality of the limited absoluteness of national sovereignty, which used to be the organizing principle of so much of international life, in the really fundamental internationalization of human rights, and indeed of the right to development itself, lodged very deeply in the human development credo that UNDP holds very dear. But it's a credo which now has some application beyond an absolute right of governments to manage their own affairs, a sense that individuals' rights have a place too, and that therefore the global community has some countersay to the absolute say of government. So governments are challenged in one direction that they can no longer solve problems alone, but they're challenged in another, in that they no longer have the absolute right to fail that was allowed them in the past. And at a third level, you see an emerging international machinery of governance. And I was struck after just last weekend, the heads of the UN agencies gathered, as we do every 6 months, in New York. And let me tell you, it's a pretty odd lot. Some of these agencies go back to the 19th century, long before the UN. When we start a round table on what they've been doing, usually I have to sort of take a very deep breath and some extra caffeine to see myself through it. But this time it was an extraordinary demonstration of the new multilateralism in action. The man who runs the Interpostal Union, which since the 19th century has been based in Bern, Switzerland, explained the meeting he just had of postal authorities to try and put together measures to prevent anthrax-treated mail being sent through the international mail system. The man who runs the International Maritime Organization based here in London explained the steps that were being taken to try and prevent explosives being shipped in international cargo containers. Gro Brundtland, the head of the World Health Organization, explained how she'd had to rush out updated global guidelines on anthrax and smallpox. The head of the UN drug control program explained the impact on the heroin economy of the military action currently going on in Afghanistan. There was just a sense that these early, some of them rather sclerotic sinews of a multilateralism that have been developing since the 19th century were suddenly coming into their own. And obviously, to listen to the head of the IMF and the World Bank in the same meeting describing the scenarios for the likely scenarios for the global economy over the next year was another critical component of this emerging new sort of re-innovation and re-energization of the structures of multilateralism. But let me just say that if that is a framework for change and a rationale for global management of some issues, it can only work if we have a real sense of what we have to urgently achieve on the global level. It's not enough to say that there may be some modest and perhaps not permanent sort of reweighting of power between governments and their citizens and international organizations and international human rights movements. That may be nice, but unless that is reinforced by a real agenda which draws on it, I don't think it takes us very far. And I think the real lessons, therefore, for globalization, the agenda that we have to address, starts with going back to who those terrorists were and to say that even before we address poverty, the democratic governance gap in the world has to be addressed. That absence of political voice in so many of the countries from which the terrorists hailed is the starting fault line of our failure in so much of the world today. It's that absence of political voice at home which has led us so frequently in the past, go back and read Conrad on terrorism, has led to the internationalizing of terrorism because of the closing of political doors at home for a democratic debate. The second critical issue which has to be addressed is education. So much of the clash now of societies, or at least the risk of the clash of societies, and so much at least of the radicalization which fed this particular reflection of a flawed globalization, rests not just on the absence of educational opportunity for many, but the direction that education in so many countries is taking, away from the critical self-examination of ideas which lies at the heart of the Western education model, if you like, to something which has allowed for many very little of that same questioning, critical approach to learning. Third, jobs. A global system which cannot solve the job crisis in the world, both through the creation of economic growth, the generation of new jobs, the review of what it means to be employed, but a system which cannot, in a comprehensive global way, respond to that is clearly one which people will not retain faith in. Then gender. What is true of so many parts of the world where we work is that half the workforce is disabled. Disabled by gender from full participation in the economic opportunities and the economic growth of their societies. And the victims of that are the societies themselves. Their single greatest opportunity left on one side, denied property rights, denied leadership roles in the society, forced to operate either within the household or in a very informal, marginal sector of the economy in still too many countries. The next issue is the whole sort of sustainable environment issue, that common environment has to be protected. The real victims of its deterioration are the poor. It hits us in our leisure activities, but as I said, in Gujarat and elsewhere, it hits you in your very right to life. And behind that, of course, lie the two major twin ideas of the recent weeks, security and prosperity. The sense that security is a much broader issue than just what happened in New York. UNDP, in its Human Development Report, which Lord Desai has been so influential in the preparation of for so many years, started using the term human security in, I think, 1994. And we used it to describe not the security of us in our places of work and homes, but of the poor in their places of work and homes. The rise of criminality in the large megacities of the developing world. The loss of job security in the rural economy and the replacement of it by very insubstantial, marginal cash economy existence in the urban economy. The breakdown of community and family tied to that rural-urban migration and population explosion. And I think what this has shown us is the indelible links between all our security. A solution for other people's security is a solution for our own. And above that and beyond that, the issue of prosperity, a commitment to a global system which we all feel an involvement in and a participation in, requires very, very clearly a sense of a common shared future prosperity, that our kids will enjoy better education than we did, better economic opportunities than we did. I think to have lived in America off and on for the years I have done gives you a sense of the enormous, important social cohesion that comes in a multi-ethnic world from the sense that we can all improve the lives of ourselves and our families and communities together, that we're not forced into these competitive situations which so often turn violent in how we share a reducing cake. So I think we see, secondly, if I might say that that's a development agenda, we also see, secondly, a conflict and crisis prevention agenda, a sense that issues such as the Palestinian-Israeli issue or HIV/AIDS cannot any more be allowed left to fester. They may not have been the direct causation of these events, but the more permanent lesson is this sense that global problems, or at least national problems left to fester in one corner of the world, will come home to roost elsewhere with a terrible vengeance later, if unaddressed. And I could make the same argument, not just in the sectors we've talked about now, but of financial crises. The Argentinian-Turkish crisis of emerging market finance that we see today, left to play out without some kind of management, risks jeopardy more broadly to international financial markets, although not that today they need much encouragement to draw further in on themselves. But let me say that this vision of a failure to address global problems with much political robustness and a failure of governments themselves to answer the demands of their people for voice, education, and economic opportunity means that in its broadest sense, I believe the events we've lived through in recent weeks are not, as some commentators would say, a failure of Islam. They are a failure of government. We live in a world which is not over-governed, but under-governed, in the sense of accountable states which are meeting the needs of their people in a way which people feel responds and is accountable to them. And that is the challenge. We need at both the global and national and community levels a distributive and inclusive model of politics that offers voice and prosperity to all, rather than a divisive one which seems intent on creating a world of winners and losers. Now, is there an organizing principle that allows us to move from late Lloyd George liberals to early Labourites? And I don't think the organizing principle, just to be clear, is a huge expansion in international governance. I think it is much more these fluent campaigns and partnerships between the global, national, and community and special interest parties to policy change. But I think there is, perhaps, an organizing principle for this, and it is that phrase, human security. It is the sense that your security is my security. And what does it allow? It allows a much more robust and legitimate and proactive interventionism in the problems of today's world. In tomorrow's Afghanistan's, it's not to draw the wrong lesson of Afghanistan Afghanistan is yesterday's home for terrorism. It's a failed state on its way out. The issue is tomorrow's home for terrorism. And if that terrorism indeed feeds on and exploits the opportunities politically and security-wise of failed states, we have to be much more vigorous in preventive strategies which address those states' failures and try to reverse them before we reach the point we have today. Second, it requires a much clearer social compact between citizens and their government and governments and the international community. A much stronger sense that issues, the privilege of failing to get things right is not an absolute principle for governments. To fail to address the environment, to fail to address economic failure or their own job crisis is no longer a privilege for governments. There has to be a much clearer sense of accountability, upwards and downwards. And therefore, third, the promotion of a vision of global public goods as done through, not, as I say, an expansion of international organizations, but through the right kind of partnerships between different levels of government in the world and partnerships with non-government players, both the private sector and civil society and others. And finally, an understanding that as we move to what is frankly a much more managed vision of globalization, where we preserve the economic opportunities of open markets and accelerated velocity of global trade and communications, as we seek to preserve those gains by managing the impacts and ensuring that the model works for all, it requires us to move beyond this minimalist market-based sense of what globalization means. If I can now go back way before Lloyd George even, to when the king considered it his duty to make the highways safe and the borders safe of the realm, to a much more activist vision of the role of the international community and the accountability of national governments to their own citizens and to that international community for a managed globalization, inclusive of all, a globalization that works for the poor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for an inspiring speech, and I really hope we are on the edge of a paradigmatic shift. I think we have 15 minutes, so what I suggest is that we take two or three questions and then we ask Mark Mallett-Brown to reply, and if we have time we'll have another round. So who would like to ask a question? By the way, give your name and everything when you ask a question, what you're doing.
My name is Martin Reiser, I work for the EBRD. I have a question regarding the privilege of failure. You said that's no longer the right to govern. I don't quite get your sense of what is the solution to failed states. And I mean, you can choose to answer with reference to a particular case, say in Zimbabwe, or you can refer to the conflict.
Okay. Yes, over there, the lady who's got her hand up.
My name is Prina, and I work for Minority Rights Group International. One of the things that I missed in your excellent presentation and analysis is a discussion of minority rights and what role this plays in the link between development and conflict. Kofi Annan is in his Millennium Report highlighted specifically that the social, economic, and political institution of these communities tend to recognize
Okay. That person in the back there. Yeah. No, sorry, the other one. This one. Yeah, sorry.
You've very successfully presented these I think we will just take this gentleman in the front because I think he was the only other person I saw. Okay.
You mentioned growth 5% to open market countries. If half the world is only earning $2 a day, 5% to 10 cents a day, this is totally meaningless. And I do think it will be helpful in economies to start looking at people and not at statistics, many of which are dubious and invented to start off with, particularly in other countries that have not written it. I would like to ask a question about the role of the World Bank and IMF. I mean, there are some of us, maybe I'm in a minority of one, believe that structural adjustment policies and its lending policies are largely responsible for a lot of the poverty in the world today. These agencies, in my experience, are unaccountable.
Can you just ask a question?
What's your comments on that? Are they unaccountable? How can we make them more accountable, more open to people like myself?
Let me just see how many, because we're not going to have time for a second round. We have five questions, and I think we don't have time for five. I think we have time for two. So I'll take you and the person right at the back, because that's the order I saw you in. And then the person right at the back? No, the one behind you, sorry.
My name is Sandeep, I'm a student here from the LC. You mapped out the human development agenda for the next years. The next big opportunity for the UN system to tackle the problems at the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg next year. How do you want to ensure that that conference tackles all the problems and is more of a success as
I'm going to add one myself, which is one of the subjects you didn't list was migration. And I think there is a very serious point that's made by the protesters that liberals talk about the free movement of capital and the free movement of trade, but not the free movement of labour. And if we're going to have a paradigmatic shift, shouldn't we address that issue?
Well, thank you. A lot. Let me start with the very interesting issue about rights of government, pushing me to be a little bit clearer about what I mean about they're no longer having the absolute right to fail. Just as Kofi Annan with the argument of humanitarian intervention, which was one of the things cited in his Nobel citation, is having difficulty in framing it precisely enough to give it some intellectual punch without ending up with half the General Assembly against him, how much more difficult is for me to take it the next step and broaden it to a developmental right of intervention. And, my vision of it is not a developmental right in a prescriptive sense, which allows me under an article something or other to interfere in a country's affairs. It's more a growing international consciousness of when bad government exists, neighbors and human rights and minority rights organizations have an obligation to coalesce to press for change. And in that sense, if I were to take Zimbabwe, a country that we have been extremely involved in trying to find a land reform solution to, the efforts of the Secretary General and myself went so far. But what is actually now driving it in a somewhat more positive direction is the engagement of the neighbors, the region. And for me, the illustrative moment was sitting in Maputo with President Chissano a month or so ago and him pulling out a map and pointing to Mozambique's absolute dependence on a healthy Zimbabwean economy to restore the Mozambican economic miracle, whether it's trade with Zimbabwe through the Barra port, etc., etc. And it's a consciousness which, if you listen carefully to what President Obasanjo, who's led the so-called Commonwealth Abuja process, to push the as a settlement in Zimbabwe forward, all the Southern African leaders have said, they constantly refer to this language, that the regional impact of Zimbabwe means Zimbabwe is no longer only Zimbabwe's problem. So for me, it's an illustration of this shifting of the rights and levels of politics. It's starting to allow a broader array of actors to intervene. I certainly think, by the way, that there is something of a trade-off between security and democratization. I cannot resist observing in parts of the world where you're working, the EBRD world, that we have a lot of countries, which are middle-income countries, which have been, in terms of their use of development assistance, extremely inefficient. I would go further. They are awash in aid, they've not used well, and you know, have indeed used development flows to prevent the necessary economic and political reforms. It sustained failed economic models and promoted the continuation of authoritarian governments. Well, if in the interests of a new sort of security version of the subjugation of development assistance away from the efforts since 1989 to build a rationale for it of effectiveness, that we put our development assistance where it works and where it reduces poverty. If we are now to go back to a security-based assignment of aid where it goes to allies, not good performers, there is a real risk that far from it promoting democratization, it will fuel exactly the worst aspects of those societies, a sclerotic failure to reform, which created the problem in the first place. So I think, you know, we need to be aware of that. On the minority rights point, you know, I think that what is fascinating about the argument about governance is that we're now beyond the rhetoric, and we were beyond it way before September the 11th. You know, 2 years ago when I first came to UNDP, I was hammered across the developing world for my argument that democratic governance was the indispensable software, human software and institutional software for successful development. That is now absolutely accepted across the developing world. The debate has moved beyond it being some kind of perverse donor political conditionality to issues of what does democratic governance mean in particular national contexts and at particular steps of economic development. And the key issue in that is minority rights. You know, there are many countries which, for reasons of ethnic division and class divisions over many years, cannot move to a simple winner-takes-all model of democracy. And so I think the discussion is just getting richer and more fascinating and important on that. Let me take a couple of questions about globalization's hubris and nemesis and whether globalization will survive the recession together. Because I do think these are, you know, short time for the economic reasons as well as the reasons I discussed in my presentation, you know, are not great times for globalization. This recession is getting wider every day and deeper. And let me tell you, if it looks bad here, try visiting the developing world at the moment. The capital markets are closed. Now, for very poor people, that may not be immediately relevant because they didn't have access to capital in the first place. Nevertheless, the knock-on effects in terms of the level of economic activity are, you know, really already quite striking, a little bit offset by lower oil prices and some other things. But over time, there's little doubt that the impact of this recession will be very significant. But I think that the sinews of globalization, this security dimension that I developed this morning, that, like it or not, technology has ensured we live in one world, means that the idea of retreat behind national walls is improbable. The issue is whether we get a healthy, proactive globalization, or if you like, a negative globalization driven only by market forces. So I think it's more a debate about whose globalization, rather than globalization, yes or no. And so I think it's very important we engage to make sure it is the model we want. And in that regard, I completely agree with Mary's last point that, you know, it is everybody champions that the new things we've added to globalization this time round over 100 years ago, we point to the power of modern communications to make us all a sort of McLuhan-esque global village. The reality is the absence of migration rights, the single most distinguishing feature of the end of the 19th century, is a dramatic difference. A very large number of people died in countries they were not born in at that period of time. It was an extraordinary moment of a global melting pot. And we are not sustaining this trade technology-based communications with that same interaction and communing of people. And I think that is a huge risk and jeopardy in the model. Let me just say that I completely take the point on statistics, which is why I use that opening statistic so cautiously. As the person responsible ultimately for the Human Development Report, others write it, I just make sure they get paid. But nevertheless, let me just say that, you know, the whole philosophical assumption of that is that poverty is more than income. And that these other dimensions about the quality of life are critical. And that if you have huge inequalities and just have growth, that growth will be distributed on the basis of the inequality. So it's, the numbers are even worse. In a poor country, if 70% of the people only have 20% of the wealth, they'll only get 20% of the growth. So the distortion is even worse. Now, on the World Bank and structural adjustment, you know, in a sense, I hate to end with it because I hope it's yesterday's argument. I think these institutions have and are moving a long way. I think they are much more open and accountable. And, you know, I think that they recognize as much as any of us the responsibility to make these institutions work. They're looking for having made a difference at a time when I think we all are struggling to make sure the world tips in the right rather than the wrong direction. So, yes, WSSD next year. I have been very clear to the South Africans that they don't need another Durban. We, none of us do. In that sense, the South African Environment Minister has proved a real early leader in trying to pull together a good agenda for this World Sustainable Development Conference. But we've also got to recognize that while there's a momentary point of agreement around security and terrorism, there is much less agreement on this broader economic and development and social agenda that I have described this morning. And I don't think WSSD, therefore, will be the answer to this, but a step towards building the consensus for this much more activist internationalism that I've described to you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That was great. And I just want to tell everybody that the next Global Governance event is next Wednesday, 6 o'clock, Dr. Helmut Anhar, chaired by Professor Peter Townsend, on dimensions of global civil society. So see you all there.